found it. Out of curiosity, I opened another of the cases very quickly and found it stacked to the top with perhaps 15 kimono, and the others, whose lids I lifted, were all the same. To see that storehouse crowded with cases, I understood at once why Granny was so terrified of fire. The collection of kimono was probably twice as valuable as the entire villages of Yoroido and Sunzuru put together. And as I learned much later, the most expensive ones were in storage somewhere else. They were worn only by apprentice geisha, and since Hatsumomo could no longer wear them, they were kept in a rented vault for safekeeping until they were needed again. By the time I returned to the courtyard, Hatsumomo had been up to her room to fetch an inkstone and a stick of ink, as well as a brush for calligraphy. I thought perhaps she wanted to write a note and slip it inside the kimono when she refolded it. She had dribbled some water from the well onto her inkstone and was now sitting on the walkway grinding ink. When it was good and black, she dipped a brush in it and smoothed its tip against the stone, so that all the ink was absorbed in the brush and none of it would drip. Then she put it into my hand and held my hand over the lovely kimono and said to me, "Practice your calligraphy, little Chiyo." This kimono, belonging to the geisha named Mameha, whom I'd never heard of at that time, was a work of art. Weaving its way from the hem up to the waist was a beautiful vine made of heavily lacquered threads, bunched together like a tiny cable and sewn into place. It was a part of the fabric, yet it seemed so much like an actual vine growing there, I had the feeling I could take it in my fingers if I wished, and tear it away like a weed from the soil. The leaves curling from it seemed to be fading and drying in the autumn weather, and even taking on tints of yellow. "I can't do it, Hatsumomo-san," I cried.
"What a shame, little sweetheart," her friend said to me, "because if you make Hatsumomo tell you again, you'll lose the chance to find your sister."
"Oh, shut up, Corin. Chiyo knows she has to do what I tell her. Write something on the fabric, Miss Stupid. I don't care what it is." When the brush first touched the kimono, Corin was so excited she let out a squeal that woke one of the elderly maids, who leaned out into the corridor with a cloth around her head and her sleeping robe sagging all around her. Hatsumomo stamped her foot and made a sort of lunging motion like a cat, which was enough to make the maid go back to her futon. Corin wasn't happy with the few uncertain strokes I'd made on the powdery green silk, so Hatsumomo instructed me where to mark the fabric and what sorts of marks to make. There wasn't any meaning to them. Hatsumomo was just trying in her own way to be artistic. Afterward, she refolded the kimono in its wrapping of linen and tied the strings shut again. She and Corin went back to the front entryway to put their lacquered zori back on their feet. When they rolled open the door to the street, Hatsumomo told me to follow.
"Hatsumomo-san, if I leave the okie without permission, Mother will be very angry and—"
"I'm giving you permission," Hatsumomo interrupted. "We have to return the kimono, don't we? I hope you're not planning to keep me waiting." So I could do nothing but step into my shoes and follow her up the alleyway to a street running beside the narrow Shirakawa stream. Back in those days, the streets and alleys in Gion were still paved beautifully with stone. We walked along in the moonlight for a block or so beside the weeping cherry trees that drooped down over the black water, and finally across a wooden bridge arching over into a section of Gion I'd never seen before. The embankment of the stream was stone, most of it covered with patches of moss. Along its top, the backs of the tea houses and okia connected to form a wall. Reed screens over the windows sliced the yellow light into tiny strips that made me think of what the cook had done to a pickled radish earlier that day. I could hear the laughter of a group of men and geisha. Something very funny must have been happening in one of the tea houses, because each wave of laughter was louder than the one before, until they finally died away and left only the twanging of a shamisen from another party. For the moment, I could imagine that Gion was probably a cheerful place for some people. I couldn't help wondering if Satsu might be at one of those parties, even though Awajiumi at the Gion Registry office had told me she wasn't in Gion at all. Shortly, Hatsumomo and Corinne came to a stop before a wooden door. "You're going to take this kimono up the stairs and give it to the maid there," Hatsumomo said to me. "Or if Miss Perfect herself answers the door, you may give it to her. Don't say anything. Just hand it over. We'll be down here watching you." With this, she put the wrapped kimono into my arms, and Corinne rolled open the door. Polished wooden steps led up into the darkness. I was trembling with fear so much, I could go no farther than halfway up them before I came to a stop. Then I heard Corinne say into the stairwell in a loud whisper, "Go on, little girl. No one's going to eat you unless you come back down with the kimono still in your hands, and then we just might. Right, Hatsumomo-san?" Hatsumomo let out a sigh at this, but said nothing. Corinne was squinting up into the darkness trying to see me, but Hatsumomo, who stood not much higher than Corinne's shoulder, was chewing on one of her fingernails and paying no attention at all. Even then, amid all my fears, I couldn't help noticing how extraordinary Hatsumomo's beauty was. She may have been as cruel as a spider, but she was more lovely, chewing on her fingernail, than most geisha looked posing for a photograph. And the contrast with her friend, Corinne, was like comparing a rock along the roadside with a jewel. Corinne looked uncomfortable in her formal hairstyle, with all its lovely ornaments, and her kimono seemed to be always in her way, whereas Hatsumomo wore her kimono as if it were her skin. On the landing at the top of the stairs, I knelt in the black darkness and called out, "Excuse me, please." I waited, but nothing happened.
"Louder," said Corinne. "They aren't expecting you."
So I called again,
"Excuse me?"
"Just a moment,"
I heard a muffled voice say, and soon the door rolled open. The girl kneeling on the other side was no older than Satsu, but thin and nervous as a bird. I handed her the kimono in its wrapping of linen paper. She was very surprised and took it from me almost desperately.
"Who's there, Asami-san?"
called a voice from inside the apartment. I could see a single paper lantern on an antique stand burning beside a freshly made futon. The futon was for the geisha, Mameha. I could tell because of the crisp sheets and the elegant silk cover, as well as the takamakura, tall pillow, just like the kind Hatsumomo used. It wasn't really a pillow at all, but a wooden stand with a padded cradle for the neck. This was the only way a geisha could sleep without ruining her elaborate hairstyle. The maid didn't answer, but opened the wrapping around the kimono as quietly as she could, and tipped it this way and that to catch the reflection of the light. When she caught sight of the ink marring it, she gasped and covered her mouth. Tears spilled out almost instantly onto her cheeks, and then a voice called out,
"Asami-san, who's there?"
"Oh, no one, miss," cried the maid.
I felt terribly sorry for her as she dried her eyes quickly against one sleeve. While she was reaching up to slide the door closed, I caught a glimpse of her mistress. I could see at once why Hatsumomo called Mameha Miss Perfect. Her face was a perfect oval, just like a doll's, and as smooth and delicate-looking as a piece of china, even without her makeup. She walked toward the doorway, trying to peer into the stairwell, but I saw no more of her before the maid quickly rolled the door shut. The next morning, after lessons, I came back to the Okia to find that Mother, Granny, and Auntie were closed up together in the formal reception room on the first floor. I felt certain they were talking about the kimono, and sure enough, the moment Hatsumomo came in from the street, one of the maids went to tell Mother, who stepped out into the entrance hall and stopped Hatsumomo on her way up the stairs.
"We had a little visit from Mameha and her maid this morning," she said.
Oh, Mother, I know just what you're going to say. I feel terrible about the kimono. I tried to stop Chio before she put ink on it, but it was too late. She must have thought it was mine. I don't know why she's hated me so from the moment she came here. To think she would ruin such a lovely kimono just in the hopes of hurting me. By now, Auntie had limped out into the hall. She cried, "Mate Mashita." I understood her words perfectly well. They meant, "We've waited for you." But I had no idea what she meant by them. Actually, it was quite a clever thing to say, because this was what the audience sometimes shouts when a great star makes his entrance in a kabuki play. "Auntie, are you suggesting that I had something to do with ruining that kimono?" Hatsumomo said. "Why would I do such a thing?" "Everyone knows how you hate Mameha," Auntie told her. "You hate anyone more successful than you." "Does that suggest I ought to be extremely fond of you, Auntie, since you're such a failure?"
"There'll be none of that," said Mother. "Now you listen to me, Hatsumomo. You don't really think anyone is empty-headed enough to believe your little story. I won't have this sort of behavior in the Okya, even from you. I have great respect for Mameha. I don't want to hear of anything like this happening again. As for the kimono, someone has to pay for it. I don't know what happened last night, but there's no dispute about who was holding the brush. The maid saw the girl doing it. The girl will pay," said Mother, and put her pipe back into her mouth.
Now Granny came out of the reception room and called a maid to fetch a bamboo pole.
"Chio has enough debts," said Auntie. "I don't see why she should pay Hatsumomo's as well."
"We've talked about this enough," Granny said. "The girl should be beaten and made to repay the cost of the kimono, and that's that. Where's the bamboo pole?"
"I'll beat her myself," Auntie said. "I won't have your joints flaring up again, Granny. Come along, Chio."
Auntie waited until the maid brought the pole and then led me down to the courtyard. She was so angry her nostrils were bigger than usual and her eyes were bunched up like fists. I'd been careful since coming to the Okya not to do anything that would lead to a beating. I felt hot suddenly, and the stepping stones at my feet grew blurry. But instead of beating me, Auntie leaned the pole against the storehouse and then limped over to say quietly to me,
"What have you done to Hatsumomo? She's bent on destroying you. There must be a reason, and I want to know what it is."
"I promise you, Auntie, she's treated me this way since I arrived. I don't know what I ever did to her."
"Granny may call Hatsumomo a fool, but believe me, Hatsumomo is no fool. If she wants to ruin your career badly enough, she'll do it. Whatever you've done to make her angry, you must stop doing it."
"I haven't done anything, Auntie, I promise you."
"You must never trust her, not even if she tries to help you. Already she's burdened you with so much debt, you may never work it off."
"I don't understand," I said, "about debt."
"Hatsumomo's little trick with that kimono is going to cost you more money than you've ever imagined in your life. That's what I mean about debt."
"But how will I pay?"
"When you begin working as a geisha, you'll pay the Okya back for it, along with everything else you'll owe, your meals and lessons, if you get sick, your doctor's fees. You pay all of that yourself. Why do you think Mother spends all her time in her room, writing numbers in those little books? You owe the Okya even for the money it cost to acquire you."
Throughout my months in Gion, I'd certainly imagined that money must have changed hands before Satsu and I were taken from our home. I often thought of the conversation I'd overheard between Mr. Tanaka and my father, and of what Mrs. Fidget had said about Satsu and me being suitable. I'd wondered with horror whether Mr. Tanaka had made money by helping to sell us, and how much we had cost, but I'd never imagined that I myself would have to repay it.
"You won't pay it back until you've been a geisha a good long time," she went on, "and you'll never pay it back if you end up a failed geisha like me. Is that the way you want to spend your future?"
At the moment, I didn't much care how I spent my future. If you want to ruin your life in Gion, there are a dozen ways to do it, Auntie said. You can try to run away. Once you've done that, Mother will see you as a bad investment. She's not going to put more money into someone who might disappear at any time. That would mean the end of your lessons, and you can't be a geisha without training. Or you can make yourself unpopular with your teachers, so they won't give you the help you need. Or you can grow up to be an ugly woman like me. I wasn't such an unattractive girl when Granny bought me from my parents, but I didn't turn out well, and Granny's always hated me for it. One time she beat me so badly for something I did that she broke one of my hips. That's when I stopped being a geisha, and that's the reason I'm going to do the job of beating you myself rather than letting Granny get her hands on you. She led me to the walkway and made me lie down on my stomach there. I didn't much care whether she beat me or not. It seemed to me that nothing could make my situation worse. Every time my body jolted under the pole, I wailed as loudly as I dared and pictured Hatsumomo's lovely face smiling down at me. When the beating was over, Auntie left me crying there. Soon, I felt the walkway tremble under someone's footsteps and sat up to find Hatsumomo standing above me. "Chiyo, I would be ever so grateful if you'd get out of my way." "You promised to tell me where I could find my sister, Hatsumomo," I said to her. "So I did." She leaned down so that her face was near mine. I thought she was going to tell me I hadn't done enough yet, that when she thought of more for me to do, she would tell me. But this wasn't at all what happened. "Your sister is in a Joruya called Tatsuyu," she told me, "in the district of Miyagawa-cho, just south of Gion." When she was done speaking, she gave me a little shove with her foot, and I stepped down out of her way. Chapter 7. I'd never heard the word Joruya before, so the very next evening, when Auntie dropped a sewing tray onto the floor of the entrance hall and asked my help in cleaning it up, I said to her, "Auntie, what is a Joruya?" Auntie didn't answer, but just went on reeling up a spool of thread. "Auntie," I said again. "It's the sort of place Hatsumomo will end up, if she ever gets what she deserves," she said. She didn't seem inclined to say more, so I had no choice but to leave it at that. My question certainly wasn't answered, but I did form the impression that Satsu might be suffering even more than I was. So I began thinking about how I might sneak to this place called Tatsuyu the very next time I had an opportunity. Unfortunately, part of my punishment for ruining Mameha's kimono was confinement in the Okia for 50 days. I was permitted to attend the school as long as Pumpkin accompanied me, but I was no longer permitted to run errands. I suppose I could have dashed out the door at any time if I'd wanted to, but I knew better than to do something so foolish. To begin with, I wasn't sure how to find the Tatsuyu, and what was worse, the moment I was discovered missing, Mr. Beku or someone would be sent to look for me. A young maid had run away from the Okia next door only a few months earlier, and they brought her back the following morning. They beat her so badly over the next few days that her wailing was horrible. Sometimes I had to put my fingers in my ears to shut it out. I decided I had no choice but to wait until my 50-day confinement was over. In the meantime, I put my efforts into finding ways to repay Hatsumomo and Granny for their cruelty. Hatsumomo I repaid by scraping up pigeon droppings whenever I was supposed to clean them from the stepping stones in the courtyard and mixing them in with her face cream. The cream already contained unguent of nightingale droppings, as I've mentioned, so maybe it did her no harm, but it did give me satisfaction. Granny I repaid by wiping the toilet rag around the inside of her sleeping robe, and I was very pleased to see her sniffing at it in puzzlement, though she never took it off. Soon I discovered that the cook had taken it upon herself to punish me further over the kimono incident, even though no one had asked her to, by cutting back on my twice-monthly portions of dried fish. I couldn't think of how to repay her for this until one day I saw her chasing a mouse down the corridor with a mallet. She hated mice worse than cats did, as it turned out. So I swept mouse droppings from under the foundation of the main house and scattered them here and there in the kitchen. I even took a chopstick one day and gouged a hole in the bottom of a canvas bag of rice, so she'd have to take everything out of all the cabinets and search for signs of rodents. One evening, as I was waiting up for Hatsumomo, I heard the telephone ring, and Yoko came out a moment later and went up the stairs. When she came back down, she was holding Hatsumomo's shamisen, disassembled in its lacquer carrying case. "You'll have to take this to the Mizuki Tea House," she said to me. "Hatsumomo has lost a bet and has to play a song on a shamisen. I don't know what's gotten into her, but she won't use the one the tea house has offered. I think she's just stalling, since she hasn't touched a shamisen in years." Yoko apparently didn't know I was confined to the Okia, which was no surprise, really. She was rarely permitted to leave the maid's room in case she should miss an important telephone call, and she wasn't involved in the life of the Okia in any way. I took the shamisen from her while she put on her kimono overcoat to leave for the night. And after she had explained to me where to find the Mizuki Tea House, I slipped into my shoes in the entryway, tingling with nervousness that someone might stop me. The maids and Pumpkin, even the three older women, were all asleep, and Yoko would be gone in a matter of minutes. It seemed to me my chance to find my sister had come at last. I heard thunder rumble overhead, and the air smelled of rain. So I hurried along the streets, past groups of men and geisha. Some of them gave me peculiar looks, because in those days we still had men and women in Gion who made their living as shamisen porters. They were often elderly. Certainly none of them were children. It wouldn't surprise me if some of the people I passed thought I'd stolen the shamisen and was running away with it. When I reached the Mizuki Tea House, rain was beginning to fall, but the entrance was so elegant I was afraid to set foot in it. The walls beyond the little curtain that hung in the doorway were a soft orange hue, trimmed in dark wood. A path of polished stone led to a huge vase holding an arrangement of twisted branches from a maple tree with their brilliant red leaves of fall. At length, I worked up my courage and brushed past the little curtain. Near the vase, a spacious entryway opened to one side, with a floor of coarsely polished granite. I remember being astounded that all the beauty I'd seen wasn't even the entryway to the tea house, but only the path leading to the entryway. It was exquisitely lovely, as indeed it should have been, because although I didn't know it, I was seeing for the first time one of the most exclusive tea houses in all of Japan. And a tea house isn't for tea, you see. It's the place where men go to be entertained by geisha. The moment I stepped into the entryway, the door before me rolled open. A young maid, kneeling on the raised floor inside, gazed down at me. She must have heard my wooden shoes on the stone. She was dressed in a beautiful dark blue kimono with a simple pattern in gray. A year earlier, I would have taken her to be the young mistress of such an extravagant place, but now, after my months in Gion, I recognized at once that her kimono, though more beautiful than anything in Yoroido, was far too simple for a geisha or for the mistress of a tea house, and of course her hairstyle was plain as well. Still, she was far more elegant than I was, and looked down at me with contempt. "Go to the back," she said. "Hatsumomo has asked that..." "Go to the back," she said again, and rolled the door shut without waiting for me to reply. The rain was falling more heavily now, so I ran, rather than walked, down a narrow alley alongside the tea house. The door to the back entrance rolled open as I arrived, and the same maid knelt there waiting for me. She didn't say a word, but just took the shamisen case from my arms. "Miss," I said, "may I ask, can you tell me where the Miyagawa Cho district is?" "Why do you want to go there?" "I have to pick up something." She gave me a strange look, but then told me to walk along the river until I had passed the Minamisa Theater, and I would find myself in Miyagawa Cho. I decided to stay under the eaves of the tea house until the rain stopped. As I stood looking around, I discovered a wing of the building visible between the slats of the fence beside me. I put my eye to the fence and found myself looking across a beautiful garden at a window of glass. Inside, a lovely tatami room, bathed in orange light, a party of men and geisha sat around a table scattered with sake cups and glasses of beer. Hatsumomo was there, too, and a bleary-eyed old man who seemed to be in the middle of a story. Hatsumomo was amused about something, though evidently not by what the old man was saying. She kept glancing at another geisha with her back to me. I found myself remembering the last time I had peered into a tea house with Mr. Tanaka's little daughter, Kuniko, and began to feel that same sense of heaviness I'd felt so long ago at the graves of my father's first family, as if the earth were pulling me down toward it. A certain thought was swelling in my head, growing until I couldn't ignore it any longer. I wanted to turn away from it, but I was as powerless to stop that thought from taking over my mind as the wind is to stop itself from blowing. So I stepped back and sank onto the stone step of the entryway, with the door against my back, and began to cry. I couldn't stop thinking about Mr. Tanaka. He had taken me from my mother and father, sold me into slavery, sold my sister into something even worse. I had taken him for a kind man. I had thought he was so refined, so worldly. What a stupid child I had been. I would never go back to Yoroido, I decided. Or if I did go back, it would only be to tell Mr. Tanaka how much I hated him. When at last I got to my feet and wiped my eyes on the wet robe, the rain had eased to a mist. The paving stones in the alley sparkled gold from the reflection of the lanterns. I made my way back through the Taminangacho section of Gion to the Minamisa Theater with its enormous tiled roof that had made me think of a palace the day Mr. Beku brought Satsu and me from the train station. The maid at the Mizuki Tea House had told me to walk along the river past the Minamisa, but the road running along the river stopped at the theater, so I followed the street behind the Minamisa instead. After a few blocks, I found myself in an area without streetlights and nearly empty of people. I didn't know it at the time, but the streets were empty mostly because of the Great Depression. In any other era, Miyagawa-cho might have been busier even than Gion. That evening, it seemed to me a very sad place, which indeed I think it has always been. The wooden facades looked like Gion, but the place had no trees, no lovely Shirakawa stream, no beautiful entryways. The only illumination came from light bulbs in the open doorways, where old women sat on stools, often with two or three women I took to be geisha on the street beside them. They wore kimono and their hair ornaments similar to geisha, but their obi were tied in the front rather than the back. I'd never seen this before and didn't understand it, but it's the mark of a prostitute. A woman who must take her sash on and off all night can't be bothered with tying it behind her again and again. With the help of one of these women, I found the Totsuyo in a dead-end alley with only three other houses. All were marked with placards near their doors. I can't possibly describe how I felt when I saw the sign lettered Tatsuyu, but I will say that my body seemed to tingle everywhere, so much that I felt I might explode. In the doorway of the Tatsuyu sat an old woman on a stool, carrying on a conversation with a much younger woman on a stool across the alley, though really it was the old woman who did all the talking. She sat leaning back against the doorframe with her gray robe sagging partway open and her feet stuck out in a pair of zori. These were zori woven coarsely from straw, of the sort you might have seen in Yoroido, and not at all like the beautifully lacquered zori Hatsumomo wore with her kimono. What was more, this old woman's feet were bare, rather than fitted with the smooth silk tabi. And yet she thrust them out with their uneven nails, just as though she were proud of the way they looked and wanted to be sure you noticed them.
"Just another 3 weeks, you know, and I'm not coming back," she was saying. "The mistress thinks I am, but I'm not. My son's wife is going to take good care of me, you know. She's not clever, but she works hard. Didn't you meet her?"
"If I did, I don't remember," the younger woman across the way said. "There's a little girl wanting to talk with you. Don't you see her?" At this, the old woman looked at me for the first time. She didn't say anything, but she gave a nod of her head to tell me she was listening.
"Please, ma'am," I said, "do you have a girl here named Satsu?"
"We don't have any Satsu," she said.
I was too shocked to know what to say to this, but in any case, the old woman suddenly looked very alert because a man was just walking past me toward the entrance. She stood part way and gave him several bows with her hands on her knees and told him, "Welcome." When he'd entered, she put herself back down on the stool and stuck her feet out again.
"Why are you still here?" the old woman said to me. "I told you we don't have any Satsu."
"Yes, you do," said the younger woman across the way. "You're Yukio. Her name used to be Satsu. I remember."
"That's as may be," replied the old woman, "but we don't have any Satsu for this girl. I don't get myself into trouble for nothing."
I didn't know what she meant by this until the younger woman muttered that I didn't look as if I had even a single sen on me, and she was quite right. A sen, which was worth only 1/100 of a yen, was still commonly used in those days, though a single one wouldn't buy even an empty cup from a vendor. I'd never held a coin of any kind in my hand since coming to Kyoto. When running errands, I asked that the goods be charged to the Nida Okya.
"If it's money you want," I said, "Satsu will pay you."
"Why should she pay to speak to the likes of you?"
"I'm her little sister."
She beckoned me with her hand, and when I neared her, she took me by the arms and spun me around.
"Look at this girl," she said to the woman across the alley. "Does she look like a little sister to Yukio? If our Yukio was as pretty as this one, we'd be the busiest house in town. You're a liar, is what you are."
And with this, she gave me a little shove back out into the alley. I'll admit I was frightened, but I was more determined than frightened, and I'd already come this far. I certainly wasn't going to leave just because this woman didn't believe me. So I turned myself around and gave her a bow, and said to her,
"I apologize if I seem to be a liar, ma'am, but I'm not. Yukio is my sister. If you'd be kind enough to tell her Chiyo is here, she'll pay you what you want."
This must have been the right thing to say, because at last she turned to the younger woman across the alley.
"You go up for me. You're not busy tonight. Besides, my neck is bothering me. I'll stay here and keep an eye on this girl."
The younger woman stood up from her stool and walked across into the Tatsuyu. I heard her climbing the stairs inside. Finally, she came back down and said,
"Yukio has a customer. When he's done, someone will tell her to come down."
The old woman sent me into the shadows on the far side of the door to squat where I couldn't be seen. I don't know how much time passed, but I grew more and more worried that someone in the Okya might discover me gone. I had an excuse for leaving, though Mother would be angry with me just the same, but I didn't have an excuse for staying away. Finally, a man came out, picking at his teeth with a toothpick. The old woman stood to bow and thanked him for coming. And then I heard the most pleasing sound I'd heard since coming to Kyoto.
"You wanted me, ma'am?"
It was Satsu's voice.
I sprang to my feet and rushed to where she stood in the doorway. Her skin looked pale, almost gray, though perhaps it was only because she wore a kimono of garish yellows and reds, and her mouth was painted with a bright lipstick like the kind Mother wore. She was just tying her sash in the front, like the women I'd seen on my way there. I felt such relief at seeing her and such excitement I could hardly keep from rushing into her arms,
and Satsu too let out a cry and covered her hand with her mouth.
"The mistress will be angry with me," the old woman said.
"I'll come right back," Satsu told her, and disappeared inside the Tatsuyu again.
A moment or so later, she was back and dropped several coins into the woman's hand, who told her to take me into the spare room on the first floor.
"And if you hear me cough," she added, "it means the mistress is coming. Now hurry up."
I followed Satsu into the gloomy entrance hall of the Tatsuyu. Its light was brown more than yellow, and the air smelled like sweat. Beneath the staircase was a sliding door that had come off its track. Satsu tugged it open, and with difficulty managed to shut it behind us. We were standing in a tiny tatami room with only one window, covered by a paper screen. The light from outdoors was enough for me to see Satsu's form, but nothing of her features.
"Oh, Chiyo," she said,
and then she reached up to scratch her face. Or at least, I thought she was scratching her face, for I couldn't see well. It took me a moment to understand she was crying. After this, I could do nothing to hold back my own tears.
"I'm so sorry, Satsu," I told her. "It's all my fault."
Somehow or other, we stumbled toward each other in the dark until we were hugging. I found that all I could think about was how bony she'd grown. She stroked my hair in a way that made me think of my mother, which caused my eyes to well up so much I might as well have been underwater.
"Quiet, Chiyo-chan," she whispered to me,
with her face so close to mine, her breath had a pungent odor when she spoke.
"I'll get a beating if the mistress finds out you are here. Why did it take you so long?" "Oh, Satsu, I'm so sorry. I know you came to my okya months ago. The woman you spoke with there is a monster. She wouldn't give me the message for the longest time. I have to run away, Chiyo. I can't stay here in this place any longer. I'll come with you. I have a train schedule hidden under the tatami mats upstairs. I've been stealing money whenever I can. I have enough to pay off Mrs. Kishino. She gets beaten whenever a girl escapes. She won't let me go unless I pay her first."
"Mrs. Kishino? Who is she?"
"The old lady at the front door. She's going away. I don't know who will take her place. I can't wait any longer. This is a horrible spot. Never end up anywhere like this, Chiyo. You'd better go now. The mistress may be here at any moment."
"But wait. When do we run away?"
"Wait in the corner there and don't say a word. I have to go upstairs."
I did as she told me. While she was gone, I heard the old woman at the front door greet a man, and then his heavy footsteps ascended the stairs over my head. Soon, someone came down again hurriedly, and the door slid open. I felt panicked for a moment, but it was only Satsu, looking very pale.
"Tuesday. We will run away Tuesday late at night, 5 days from now. I have to go upstairs, Chiyo. A man has come for me."
"But wait, Satsu. Where will we meet? What time?"
"I don't know. 1 in the morning, but I don't know where."
I suggested we meet near the Minamisa Theater, but Satsu thought it would be too easy for people to find us. We agreed to meet at a spot exactly across the river from it.
"I have to go now," she said.
"But Satsu, what if I can't get away? Or what if we don't meet up?"
"Just be there, Chiyo. I have only one chance. I've waited as long as I can. You have to go now before the mistress comes back. If she catches you here, I may never be able to run away."
There were so many things I wanted to say to her, but she took me out into the hallway and wrenched the door shut behind us. I would have watched her go upstairs, but in a moment the old woman from the doorway had taken me by the arm and pulled me out into the darkness of the street. I ran back from Miyagawa-cho and was relieved to find the okya as quiet as I'd left it. I crept inside and knelt in the dim light of the entrance hall, dabbing the sweat from my forehead and neck with the sleeve of my robe and trying to catch my breath. I was just beginning to settle down now that I'd succeeded in not getting caught. But when I looked at the door to the maid's room and saw that it stood open a bit, just wide enough to reach an arm through, and I felt myself go cold. No one ever left it that way. Except in hot weather, it was usually closed all the way. Now, as I watched it, I felt certain I heard a rustling sound from within. I hoped it was a rat, because if it wasn't a rat, it was Hatsumomo and her boyfriend again. I began to wish I hadn't gone to Miyagawa-cho. I wished it so hard that if such a thing had been possible, I think time itself would have begun to run backward just from the force of all my wishing. I got to my feet and crept onto the dirt corridor, feeling dizzy from worry and with my throat as dry as a patch of dusty ground. When I reached the door of the maid's room, I brought my eye to the crack to peer inside. I couldn't see well. Because of the damp weather, Yoko had lit charcoal earlier that evening in the brazier set into the floor. Only a faint glow remained, and in that dim light, something small and pale was squirming. I almost let out a scream when I saw it, because I was sure it was a rat, with its head bobbing around as it chewed at something. To my horror, I could even hear the moist, smacking sounds of its mouth. It seemed to be standing up on top of something, I couldn't tell what. Stretching out toward me were two bundles of what I thought were probably rolled-up fabric, which gave me the impression it had chewed its way up between them, spreading them apart as it went. It was eating something Yoko must have left there in the room. I was just about to shut the door, for I was frightened it might run out into the corridor with me, when I heard a woman's moan. Then suddenly, from beyond, where the rat was chewing, a head raised up, and Hatsumomo was looking straight at me. I jumped back from the door. What I'd thought were bundles of rolled-up fabric were her legs, and the rat wasn't a rat at all. It was her boyfriend's pale hand protruding from his sleeve.
"What is it?" I heard her boyfriend's voice say. "Is someone there?"
"It's nothing," Hatsumomo whispered.
"Someone's there!"
"No, it's no one at all," she said. "I thought I heard something, but it's no one." There was no question in my mind Hatsumomo had seen me, but she apparently didn't want her boyfriend to know. I hurried back to kneel in the hallway, feeling as shaken as if I'd almost been run over by a trolley. I heard groans and noises coming from the maid's room for some time, and then they stopped. When Hatsumomo and her boyfriend finally stepped out into the corridor, her boyfriend looked right at me.
"That girl's in the front hall," he said. "She wasn't there when I came in."
"Oh, don't pay her any attention. She was a bad girl tonight and went out of the Okia when she wasn't supposed to. I'll deal with her later."
"So there was someone spying on us. Why did you lie to me?"
"Koichi-san," she said, "you're in such a bad mood tonight."
"You aren't the least surprised to see her. You knew she was there all along."
Hatsumomo's boyfriend came striding up to the front entrance hall and stopped to glower at me before stepping down into the entryway. I kept my eyes to the floor, but I could feel myself blush a brilliant red. Hatsumomo rushed past me to help him with his shoes. I heard her speak to him as I'd never heard her speak to anyone before, in a pleading, almost whining voice.
"Koichi-san, please," she said. "Calm down. I don't know what's gotten into you tonight. Come again tomorrow."
"I don't want to see you tomorrow."
"I hate when you make me wait so long. I'll meet you anywhere you say, on the bottom of the riverbed even."
"I don't have anywhere to meet you. My wife watches over me too much as it is."
"Then come back here. We have the maid's room."
"Yes, if you like sneaking around and being spied on. Just let me go, Hatsumomo. I want to get home."
"Please don't be angry with me, Koichi-san. I don't know why you get this way. Tell me you'll come back, even if it isn't tomorrow."
"One day I won't come back," he said. "I've told you that all along."
I heard the outside door roll open, and then it closed again. After a time, Hatsumomo came back into the front entrance hall and stood peering down the corridor at nothing. Finally, she turned to me and wiped the moisture from her eyes.
"Well, little Chio," she said, "you went to visit that ugly sister of yours, didn't you?" "Please, Hatsumomo-san," I said. "And then you came back here to spy on me."
Hatsumomo said this so loudly, she woke one of the elderly maids, who propped herself on her elbow to look at us. Hatsumomo shouted at her,
"Go back to sleep, you stupid old woman!"
And the maid shook her head and lay back down again.
"Hatsumomo-san, I'll do whatever you want me to do," I said. "I don't want to get in trouble with Mother." "Of course you'll do whatever I want you to. That isn't even a subject for discussion, and you're already in trouble." "I had to go out to deliver your shamisen."
"That was more than an hour ago. You went to find your sister, and you made plans to run away with her. Do you think I'm stupid? And then you came back here to spy on me."
"Please forgive me," I said. "I didn't know it was you there. I thought it was..."
I wanted to tell her I'd thought I'd seen a rat, but I didn't think she'd take it kindly. She peered at me for a time and then went upstairs to her room. When she came back, she was holding something in her fist.
"You want to run away with your sister, don't you?" she said. "I think that's a fine idea. The sooner you're out of the Okia, the better for me. Some people think I don't have a heart, but it isn't true. It's touching to imagine you and that fat cow going off to try to make a living someplace, all alone in the world. The sooner you're out of here, the better for me. Stand up."
I stood, though I was afraid of what she was going to do to me. Whatever she was holding in her fist, she wanted to tuck beneath the sash of my robe, but when she stepped toward me, I backed away.
"Look," she said, and opened her hand.
She was holding a number of folded bills, more money than I'd ever seen, though I don't know how much.
"I've brought this from my room for you. You don't need to thank me. Just take it. You'll repay me by getting yourself out of Kyoto, so I'll never have to see you again."
Auntie had told me never to trust Hatsumomo, even if she offered to help me. But when I reminded myself how much Hatsumomo hated me, I understood that she wasn't really helping me at all. She was helping herself to be rid of me. I stood still as she reached into my robe and tucked the bills under my sash. I felt her glassy nails brushing against my skin. She spun me around to retie the sash so the money wouldn't slip, and then she did the strangest thing. She turned me around to face her again and began to stroke the side of my head with her hand, wearing an almost motherly gaze. The very idea of Hatsumomo behaving kindly toward me was so odd, I felt as if a poisonous snake had come up and begun to rub against me like a cat. Then, before I knew what she was doing, she worked her fingers down to my scalp, and all at once she clenched her teeth in fury and took a great handful of my hair and yanked it to one side so hard I fell to my knees and cried out. I couldn't understand what was happening, but soon Hatsumomo had pulled me to my feet again and began leading me up the stairs, yanking my hair this way and that. She was shouting at me in anger while I screamed so loudly I wouldn't have been surprised if we'd woken people all up and down the street. When we reached the top of the stairs, Hatsumomo banged on Mother's door and called out for her. Mother opened it very quickly, tying her sash around her middle and looking angry.
"What is the matter with the two of you?" she said. "My jewelry," Hatsumomo said. "This stupid, stupid girl."
And here she began to beat me. I could do nothing but huddle into a ball on the floor and cry out for her to stop until Mother managed to restrain her somehow. By that time, Auntie had come to join her on the landing.
"Oh, Mother," Hatsumomo said, "on my way back to the Okia this evening, I thought I saw little Chio at the end of the alleyway talking to a man. I didn't think anything of it, because I knew it couldn't be her. She isn't supposed to be out of the Okia at all. But when I went up to my room, I found my jewelry box in disarray and rushed back down just in time to see Chio handing something over to the man. She tried to run away, but I caught her."
Mother was perfectly silent a long while, looking at me.
The man got away, Hatsumomo went on, but I think Chiyo may have sold some of my jewelry to raise money. She's planning to run away from the Okia, Mother, that's what I think, after we've been so kind to her.
All right, Hatsumomo, Mother said, that's quite enough. You and Auntie go into your room and find out what's missing.
The moment I was alone with Mother, I looked up at her from where I knelt on the floor and whispered, Mother, it isn't true. Hatsumomo was in the maid's room with her boyfriend. She's angry about something, and she's taking it out on me. I didn't take anything from her.
Mother didn't speak. I wasn't even sure she'd heard me.
Soon Hatsumomo came out and said she was missing a brooch used for decorating the front of an obi. My emerald brooch, Mother, she kept saying, and crying just like a fine actress. She sold my emerald brooch to that horrible man. It was my brooch. Who does she think she is to steal such a thing from me?
Search the girl, Mother said.
Once, when I was a little child of 6 or so, I watched a spider spinning its web in a corner of the house. Before the spider had even finished its job, a mosquito flew right into the web and was trapped there. The spider didn't pay it any attention at first, but went on with what it was doing. Only when it was finished did it creep over on its pointy toes and sting that poor mosquito to death. As I sat there on that wooden floor and watched Hatsumomo come reaching for me with her delicate fingers, I knew I was trapped in a web she had spun for me. I could do nothing to explain the cash I was carrying beneath my sash. When she drew it out, Mother took it from her and counted it.
You're a fool to sell an emerald brooch for so little, she said to me, particularly since it will cost you a good deal more to replace it.
She tucked the money into her own sleeping robe and then said to Hatsumomo,
You had a boyfriend here in the Okia tonight.
Hatsumomo was taken aback by this, but she didn't hesitate to reply, Whatever gave you such an idea, Mother? There was a long pause, and then Mother said to Auntie, Hold her arms. Auntie took Hatsumomo by the arms and held her from behind while Mother began to pull open the seams of Hatsumomo's kimono at the thigh. I thought Hatsumomo would resist, but she didn't. She looked at me with cold eyes as Mother gathered up the koshimaki and pushed her knees apart. Then Mother reached up between her legs, and when her hand came out again, her fingertips were wet. She rubbed her thumb and fingers together for a time, and then smelled them. After this, she drew back her hand and slapped Hatsumomo across the face, leaving a streak of moisture. Chapter 8 Hatsumomo wasn't the only one angry at me the following day, because Mother ordered that all the maids be denied servings of dried fish for 6 weeks, as punishment for having tolerated Hatsumomo's boyfriend in the Okia. I don't think the maids could have been more upset with me if I'd actually stolen the food from their bowls with my own hands. And as for Pumpkin, she began to cry when she found out what Mother had ordered. But to tell the truth, I didn't feel as uneasy as you might imagine to have everyone glowering at me, and to have the cost of an obi brooch I'd never seen or even touched added to my debts. Anything that made life more difficult for me only strengthened my determination to run away. I don't think Mother really believed I'd stolen the obi brooch, though she was certainly content to buy a new one at my expense, if it would keep Hatsumomo happy. But she had no doubts at all that I'd left the Okia when I shouldn't have, because Yoko confirmed it. I felt almost as though my life itself were slipping away from me, when I learned that Mother had ordered the front door locked to prevent me from going out again. How would I escape from the Okia now? Only Auntie had a key, and she kept it around her neck even while she was sleeping. As an extra measure, the job of sitting by the door in the evenings was taken away from me and given to Pumpkin instead, who had to wake Auntie to have the door unlocked when Hatsumomo came home. Every night I lay on my futon scheming, but as late as Monday, the very day before Satsu and I had arranged to run away, I'd come up with no plan for my escape.
I grew so despondent I had no energy at all for my chores, and the maids chided me for dragging my cloth along the woodwork I was supposed to be polishing, and pulling a broom along the corridor I was supposed to be sweeping. I spent a long while Monday afternoon pretending to weed the courtyard, while really only squatting on the stones and brooding. Then one of the maids gave me the job of washing the wood floor in the maids' room, where Yoko was seated near the telephone, and something extraordinary happened. I squeezed a rag full of water onto the floor, but instead of snaking along toward the doorway as I would have expected, it ran toward one of the back corners of the room.
"Yoko, look," I said. "The water's running uphill."
Of course, it wasn't really uphill. It only looked that way to me. I was so startled by this that I squeezed more water and watched it run into the corner again. And then, well, I can't say exactly how it happened, but I pictured myself flowing up the stairs to the second floor landing, and from there up the ladder, through the trap door, and onto the roof beside the gravity feed tank. The roof! I was so astonished at the thought, I forgot my surroundings completely, and when the telephone near Yoko rang, I almost cried out in alarm. I wasn't sure what I would do once I reached the roof, but if I could succeed in finding my way down from there, I might meet Satsu after all. The following evening, I made a great show of yawning when I went to bed and threw myself onto my futon, as though I were a sack of rice. Anyone watching me would have thought I was asleep within a moment, but actually, I could hardly have been more awake. I lay for a long while thinking of my house and wondering what expression would form itself on my father's face when he looked up from the table to see me standing in the doorway. Probably, the pockets at his eyes would droop down and he would start to cry, or else his mouth would take on that odd shape that was his way of smiling. I didn't allow myself to picture my mother quite so vividly. Just the thought of seeing her again was enough to bring tears to my eyes. At length, the maids settled down onto their futons beside me on the floor, and Pumpkin took up her position, waiting for Hatsumomo. I listened to Granny chanting sutras, which she did every night before going to bed. Then I watched her through the partly opened door as she stood beside her futon and changed into her sleeping robe. I was horrified by what I saw when her robe slipped from her shoulders, for I'd never seen her completely naked before. It wasn't just the chicken-like skin of her neck and shoulders. Her body made me think of a pile of wrinkled clothing. She looked strangely pitiful to me while she fumbled to unfold the sleeping robe she'd picked up from the table. Everything drooped from her, even her protruding nipples that hung like fingertips. The more I watched her, the more I came to feel that she must be struggling in that cloudy old lady's mind of hers with thoughts of her own mother and father, who had probably sold her into slavery when she was a little girl, just as I had been struggling with thoughts of my own parents. Perhaps she had lost a sister, too. I'd certainly never thought of Granny in this way before. I found myself wondering if she'd started life much as I had. It made no difference that she was a mean old woman and I was just a struggling little girl. Couldn't the wrong sort of living turn anyone mean? I remembered very well that one day back in Yoroido, a boy pushed me into a thorn bush near the pond. By the time I clawed my way out, I was mad enough to bite through wood. If a few minutes of suffering could make me so angry, what would years of it do? Even stone can be worn down with enough rain. If I hadn't already resolved to run away, I'm sure I would have been terrified to think of the suffering that probably lay in wait for me in Gion. Surely it would make me into the sort of old woman Granny had become. But I comforted myself with the thought that by the following day I could begin forgetting even my memories of Gion. I already knew how I would reach the roof. As to how I would climb from there to the street, well, I wasn't at all sure. I would have no choice but to take my chances in the dark. Even if I did make it down without hurting myself, reaching the street would be only the beginning of my troubles. However much life in Gion was a struggle, Life after running away would surely be more of a struggle. The world was simply too cruel. How could I survive? I lay on my futon in anguish for a while, wondering if I really had the strength to do it. But Satsu would be waiting for me.